It's the Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting with Jenny Finch, Rob Nichols, Jill Prowse and a host of points to ponder.
April's Book of the Month is the first of our science fiction selections, and where better to start than with William Gibson's astonishing and prophetic first novel, Neuromancer. Published in 1984, Neuromancer became a cult hit in some parts of the world and has been credited with inventing, or at least imagining, the Matrix, cyberspace, and a host of other technological developments. On one level, it is a futuristic crime novel, following Case, a computer cowboy, Gibson's name for a hacker, as he tries to infiltrate the headquarters of a megacorporation. When the book opens, Case is in a bad way. During a previous job, he double-crossed his employers, and his punishment has left him nerve-damaged and unable to jack into the Matrix. Through one error of judgment, he's lost his livelihood, his reason for living, and much of his personal identity. When a new client offers him a cure in exchange for his services, he's unable to resist.
Lifeless neon spelled out Metro Holographics in dusty capitals of glass tubing. Case picked at a shred of bacon that had lodged between his front teeth. He'd given up asking her where they were going and why. Jabs in the ribs and the sign for silence were all he'd gotten in reply. She talked about the season's fashions, about sports, about a political scandal in California he'd never heard of. He looked around the deserted dead-end street. A sheet of newsprint went cartwheeling past the intersection. Freak winds in the east side, something to do with convection and an overlap in the domes. Case peered through the window at the dead sign. Her sprawl wasn't his sprawl, he decided. She'd led him through a dozen bars and clubs he'd never seen before, taking care of business, usually with no more than a nod, maintaining connections. Something was moving in the shadows behind Metro Holographics. The door was a sheet of corrugated roofing. In front of it, Molly's hands flowed through an intricate sequence of jive that he couldn't follow. He caught the sign for cash, a thumb brushing the tip of the forefinger. The door swung inward, and she led him into the smell of dust. They stood in a clearing, dense tangles of junk rising either side, to walls lined with shelves of crumbling paperbacks. The junk looked like something that had grown there, a fungus of twisted metal and plastic. He could pick out individual objects, but then they seemed to blur back into the mess. The guts of a television so old it was studded with the glass stumps of vacuum tubes, a crumpled dish antenna, a brown fibre canister stuffed with corroded lengths of alloy tubing. An enormous pile of old magazines had cascaded into the open area, flesh of lost summer staring blindly up as he followed her back through a narrow canyon of impacted scrap. He heard the door close behind them. He didn't look back. The tunnel ended with an ancient army blanket tacked across a doorway. White light flooded out as Molly ducked past it. Four square walls of blank, white plastic, ceiling to match, floored with white hospital tile moulded in a non-slip pattern of small raised discs. In the centre stood a square, white-painted, wooden table, and four white folding chairs. The man who stood blinking now in the doorway behind them, the blankets draping one shoulder like a cape, seemed to have been designed in a wind tunnel. His ears were very small, plastered flat against his narrow skull, and his large front teeth revealed in something that wasn't quite a smile or cantered sharply backward. He wore an ancient tweed jacket and held a handgun of some kind in his left hand. He peered at them, blinked, and dropped the gun into a jacket pocket. He gestured to Case, pointed at a slab of white plastic that leaned near the doorway. Case crossed to it and saw that it was a solid sandwich of circuitry, nearly a centimetre thick. He helped the man lift it and position it in the doorway. Quick, nicotine-stained fingers secured it with a white Velcro border. A hidden exhaust fan began to purr.
The novel moves through a series of countries and settings, from Japan, where the book opens, to the innermost sanctum of the Target Corporation. Case travels in both the real world and through the realms of cyberspace, switching from one to another with bewildering speed. The physical locations are almost as strange as his vision of cyberspace, for Gibson imagines a future world riddled with poverty, overcrowding and corruption. A small and privileged class lives in comfort, but this is barely glimpsed as Gibson's heroes exist in the vast sprawl, home to the bulk of the world's citizens. There is little political consciousness or motivation behind Case's criminal activities. He seems motivated by the challenge presented by his targets, though the pull of the Matrix is also an addiction, a world he can control and in which he feels more at home than the physical universe he's forced to inhabit after his punishment.
She missed it by a fraction. She nearly cut it, but not quite. She went in just right, Case thought. The right attitude. It was something he could sense, something he could have seen in the posture of another cowboy leaning into a deck, fingers flying across the board. She had it, the thing, the moves. And she'd pulled it all together for her entrance. Pulled it together around the pain in her leg and marched down Three Jane's stairs like she owned the place, elbow of her gun arm at her hip, forearm up, wrists relaxed, swaying the muzzle of the Fletcher with the studied nonchalance of a Regency duelist. It was a performance. It was like the culmination of a lifetime's observation of martial arts tapes, cheap ones, the kind Case had grown up on. For a few seconds, he knew she was every badass hero. Sony Mao in his old Shaw videos, Mickey Chiba, the whole lineage back to Lee and Eastwood. She was walking it the way she talked it. Lady Three Jane Marie-France Tessier Ashpool had carved herself a low country flush with the inner surface of Straylight's hull, chopping away the maze of walls that was her legacy. She lived in a single room so broad and deep that its far reaches were lost to an inverse horizon, the floor hidden by the curvature of the spindle. The ceiling was low and irregular, done in the same imitation stone that walled the corridor. Here and there across the floor were jagged sections of wall, waist-high reminders of the labyrinth. There was a rectangular turquoise pool centred 10 metres from the foot of the stairway, its underwater floods the apartment's only source of light, or it seemed that way to Case as Molly took her final step. The pool threw shifting blobs of light across the ceiling above it. They were waiting by the pool. He'd known that her reflexes were souped up, jazzed by the neurosurgeons for combat, but he hadn't experienced them on the sim-stim link. The effect was like tape run at half speed, a slow, deliberate dance choreographed to the killer instinct and years of training. She seemed to take the three of them in at a glance, the boy poised on the pool's high board, the girl grinning over her wine glass, and the corpse of Ashpool, his left socket gaping black and corrupt above his welcoming smile. He wore his maroon robe. His teeth were very white. The boy dove. Slender, brown, his palm perfect. The grenade left her hand before his hands could cut the water. Case knew the thing for what it was as it broke the surface, a core of high explosive wrapped with 10 metres of fine, brittle steel wire. Her Fletcher whined as she sent a storm of explosive darts into Ashpool's face and chest, and he was gone, smoke curling from the pocked back of the empty, white-enamelled pool chair. The muzzle swung for Three Jane as the grenade detonated, a symmetrical wedding cake of water rising, breaking, falling back. But the mistake had been made. Hideo didn't even touch her then. Her leg collapsed. Ingarvi! Case screamed.
The world of the Matrix is more familiar to contemporary readers, but when it was first published, this book caused an uproar. Neuromancer uses words and language that are more familiar to us, but it was the first work to explore the visual aspects of the slowly developing web, and the idea of travelling through it as an avatar was revolutionary. The central plot works well as a crime story, with some well-drawn villains and confusion over who is actually behind Case's attack on the corporation. It is also unusual in having a highly competent and deadly female co-conspirator, something sci-fi tends to lack even today. The ending might perhaps seem a bit of a letdown to readers focusing on the action of the plot, but in many ways this is secondary. In Neuromancer, Gibson created something new and challenging, and the vision of cyberspace in all its colour, form and detail is the main point of the book. That is what makes it so memorable, and that is why it's still considered groundbreaking today.
From Airwolf, Magnum PI, and Saint Elsewhere, Native Voices and Days of Our Lives, this is Jean Bruce Scott congratulating you on your excellent taste for choosing this station and podcast.
Parkville is a purpose-built residential and nursing care centre situated at the heart of Middlesbrough, providing personalised care in a modern and homely environment. Parkville aims to help older people to continue to live independent and active lives within the wider community whilst benefiting from the care and support of an experienced and dedicated team of nursing and care staff. At Parkville, we provide facilities to accommodate residential, nursing and dementia service users. To find out more, please telephone 01642 22 33 34. That's 01642 22 33 34. Parkville Care Centre. Care to call us home.
Lincoln Inspired is more than just an arts festival, more than a literary festival, more than a whole set of lifestyle opportunities, and more than what the world has needed for millennia.
To see just how much more Lincoln Inspired can make you, go to lincolninspired.co.uk and explore the inspiration.
My wife Betty was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Through the surgery and telling our daughters, I could still remain positive, but eventually I felt there was nothing more I could do for her. That's when I felt I was falling. That's when Tony was brilliant.
I would offer support to the family wherever I could, ultimately helping Betty fulfill her wish of passing away at home.
No one should face cancer alone. With your support, more nurses like Tony can be there for people like Betty and Bill. Text Tony to 70550 to donate £5 today. We are Macmillan Cancer Support.
We receive 94p of every pound donated.
With a high-spec accommodation, all with ensuite facilities and high-quality care for residents provided 24/7 by qualified nurses and carers, Roseville Care Centre provides the perfect home for its residents' emotional, spiritual, social, physical and intellectual needs.
A purpose-built residential care facility in the heart of Ingleby Barwick, Roseville is a care centre which provides facilities to accommodate residential nursing and dementia service users, offering both short and long stay accommodation, as well as respite and daycare.
To find out more, please telephone 01642 30 81 88 or email us at roseville@prestigegroup.uk.com.
Roseville Care Centre. Care to call
it's
us home.
It's the Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting with Jenny Finch, Rob Nichols, Jill Prowse and a host of points to ponder.
Neuromancer, obviously written by William Gibson, launched the whole cyber age scenario. We've just actually heard Jenny's views on the whole point, but now it's time to actually turn to a fine soul who was one of the co-people behind the wonderful world of Linden Books in Lincoln, so it's nice to have that sort of sign for that, and we're speaking, of course, to Jill Hart.
Good afternoon, Alex.
Jill, talk us through your own views on Neuromancer by, of course, William Gibson.
Well, I read Neuromancer many years ago, in the 80s, of course, which 30-odd years ago now, which is scary and frightening. And this was my second really proper serious reread of it. And it's actually said quite a lot about the 80s, isn't it? And even though it was obviously a future dystopia. And I've kind of found myself sort of thinking about the old television series, things like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And it was almost like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. in Space and the Matrix, I thought, reading again. And the sort of development of Case as a character throughout the story was quite satisfying. At the end of the story, without giving any spoilers away too much, there is nothing dreadfully bad happening at the end. And I do think these days, in something similar, there might be a nastier ending. And I think it's back to the age of a slightly gentler age of science fiction. And it was rather nice. I enjoyed the look back.
The intriguing thing for me was actually the influence that it's actually had on eerie aspects such as The Matrix, which is cited quite explicitly in the Neuromancer, and that whole cyber age aspect. I hadn't picked up on The Man from U.N.C.L.E. aspect, Man from U.N.C.L.E. Space, which I think is interesting.
Like that. It just felt like that, I thought. It was a little bit like an aged television programme, because because he does, despite the type of character he is, that they do almost expect to save the girl, and you know, and they do expect the girl to sacrifice herself for them, and all those monthly things, you know, in those days. But
there was, of course, the girl from Uncle as well.
There was, of course. I didn't remember that so much.
Stephanie Powers
in my day. There we go. But it did remind me, and also it reminded me as I was reading it. When I first read it, I don't think I understood very little of the text stuff. I still understand very little of the text stuff. But I've now got the picture of the Matrix film. I've got the picture of the film of Blade Runner for the original, for the beginning of the Neuromancer, the world and the city he's living in. I'm picturing the set from Blade Runner. And I've got all those things that have filled me in to make it probably more visual now. I think when I first read it, I didn't get it at all.
And of course, William Gibson has said that when he saw the Ridley Scott incarnation of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, he felt as though he had to almost rip the book up and start again, because it was such a match to what he'd originally thought about in the early 80s, of course.
Yes. It's very obvious, I think, that it's coming from people who are thinking at the same time.
We don't obviously get to know Case's Christian name until, well, once. It's mentioned once, and that's it, really. Other than that, he's very much a cipher, a cyber cipher, I felt. Did you identify with the character? I mean, obviously you mentioned about the uncle thing. I found him somewhat of a kind of neutral blank canvas, really.
I thought so, but he did. But during the course of the book, he does. He starts off as this almost animalistic character with no humanity in him at all. But throughout the course of the book, Gibson does develop in him a feeling of a friendship, and particularly in the friendship with the Malcolm.
Molly?
Malcolm, people like Malcolm.
From Zion.
Yes, he gained a trusty sidekick who was totally reliable.
Eye is eye.
Yes, and things like, and of course with Molly, I felt they did develop him into an acceptable hero at the end, which I think possibly was needed at the period they were writing. I don't think an anti-hero would have been as acceptable then. Do you really?
Jill, I think that's some, as expected, very pertinent observations there. Always good to have the booksellers, the independent booksellers' views on this.
I
know you'll be pleased to hopefully meet up with Jenny Finch, the lady in the chair of Book of the Month, of course, because she's coming down to do one of our Siren FM Presents pieces, which actually helps launch the festival on the All England Inspired setup.
Wonderful. Looking forward to that very much.
And we'll continue from there. Jill Hart, once again, many thanks. And a plug for the bookstore, of course, in Lincoln. It's based, and it's called?
It's called Linden Books.
And there we are. Good to have Jill Hart join us and making her debut as far as Southside Broadcasting's Book of the Month is actually concerned. You see, there was a Jill there. Obviously, Jill Prowse doing other things, but we got a Jill Hart in. We have, obviously, the fabulous Jenny Finch in the studio. Jenny, fantastic as ever, your take on Neuromancer. And Rob Nichols, from, obviously, editor of Fly Me to the Moon and music journalist, whole top soul person. Mm-hmm. And what did you make of what you've read from Neuromancer? Because you haven't quite finished it as yet. But,
no.
in the Matrix. I'll be honest. It's a sort of book which even now you need to almost dive in and really just keep on going until you suddenly, it's almost the little synapses begin to connect. You think, I kind of get it now.
Yeah, you actually forewarned me about that. And I did find it was, a surge of information at the start. Incredible amount. And it's quite hard to take. There's so many things being signposted all the time that are everything, the whole world is sci-fi world, and you don't know what anything's about. It helps to know a little bit of background as well about some of the cities that he's going through as well, to know, because he just drops in terms to do with every city, the locations and terms to do with people that are there. If you know a little bit, then that helps. And so it is a phenomenal information overload, and it is quite, I found it quite hard to get into from that point of view at the start. And I guess the point is that you're not sure what, it's stages, you're not sure what's cyber and what's the real world. But maybe that's the point of it in a way.
Well, it's something which, as you said, that instant overload, which you've just described there as a metaphor for the whole book itself. It's suddenly, we talk about the information age. We talk about, we've moved from the industrial age into the information age. And suddenly there is this huge surge of information that comes through. And it doesn't surprise me, actually, rereading it, that a lot of students who were doing the English science fiction course that I was teaching on last year had difficulty actually getting through it. It takes time, Jenny, to really, I mean, we talk a lot about, do you identify with any of the characters? Do you connect? This, I mean, talking with Jill Hart, though, we didn't. I mean, I you may have gathered I wasn't in agreement with her Man from Uncle side of things, because I think that's a totally different adventure-based setup. In this instance, it was something where the fascinating thing for me was actually looking at it and reading it from the perspective of now 40 years after it was originally published, or thereabouts. 30 years.
I found that. I bought a copy when it first came out, and to be honest, I couldn't get through it. I had three goes at it, and I ground to a halt in roughly the same place each time. But when I came back to it about 5 or 6 years later, there was more background and more personal experience of the web and its opportunities to latch onto. And I'd seen Blade Runner, I'd read more science fiction of an older type, and I had some kind of reference point. But also, he uses a number of words in his language, and he uses descriptors, and he doesn't explain them. He expects us to understand, in much the same way that Anthony Burgess does in Clockwork Orange. He writes in Nadsat, and you just learn Nadsat and use the dictionary. Gibson doesn't even give us a dictionary, but he leaves the stuff to our imagination, and I really enjoyed it this time round.
It's probably an argument for not necessarily, always re-evaluating and actually reconsidering text.
Absolutely.
We're talking about Blade Runner, obviously the movie. We talked about the movie Matrix. Blade Runner, of course, itself based on the Philip K. Dick text, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which again can be a little bit more confusing. That's written back in the 60s, of course. But as with all of these kind of things, there's a hybridization that's there. I take the line the New York Times are quoted as saying, a masterpiece that moves faster than the speed of thought and is chilling in its implications. We are in many ways living in the kind of world, at least as far as vocabulary is concerned, that Gibson was sort of predicating Neuromancer on, really.
We are starting to use some of those words. The concepts behind the words are quite familiar, particularly to the younger generation now. And some of the events and the problems he foresees are happening now. You think about the Heartbleed virus, for example, and in some ways Case is the Heartbleed virus.
And we only get his Christian name just mentioned once.
Yes, we do. Are you going to out him?
It begins with an H, and then his middle name is D, so it's HDC. Yeah, you could actually say Hard Case. No, it's not that, actually.
No.
It's a different line, but he is actually just mentioned once. Rob, you mentioned you were finding it challenging in terms of, is it cyberspace? Is it real? Is it the real world? How does it relate to that? Of course, he actually does another thing. He actually puts us into space as well. And actually does deal with that outer space level, because that was something which threw me when there is a time period where, in terms of actually going above the planet, you've got a circular space station. That was, again, an area where I thought, oh, he's playing around with that sort of orbital thing as well, really.
Yeah. How many dimensions is that?
Well, it's there's no up, there's no down. It's all over the place, really.
Yeah.
Again, I take another quote from New Musical Express, actually, given obviously the music writing routine. Gibson is up your alley. He is a technological fantasist with unparalleled sensitivity, wired direct to the mains. That, and also the quote from Vox, which is a newspaper or magazine that's no longer around with us, but Case is the Marlowe of the mainframe age. Jenny, we haven't really talked about the hard-boiled detective, because actually there are a lot of similarities between writers such as Raymond Chandler, Philip Marlowe, and so on, in terms of the anti-hero approach of Case that maybe also comes across from Neuromancer.
I think so, yes. And I think that anti-hero is very important, because he is a virus in cyberspace, and yet cyberspace is there to serve the corporations, to serve the world. And I think you are always going to get that. I don't think he's driven by malice. He is driven by curiosity, the way a lot of hackers do actually go into things to see if they can, just to see if it's possible and to see what's there. And it drives people crackers, and I think that's all the better.
If we're looking at contemporary residences, obviously Mr. Assange, WikiLeaks, and a variety of other factors, would you see the kind of villain characters who are portrayed here, again, that they've have their own kind of portrayal? I mean, again, I find it, even the descriptions of the thing, apart from the character of Case and Molly his associate, I think, is the best phrase for it. Yeah. Because Molly is not a sidekick by any means. But she, and there is the connection in terms of the latter part of the text where Case effectively is hardwired into Molly's perception of the things that we worked through in the extract that we actually heard there, where in Garvey, on the location of Garvey, Case actually screamed. He's not actually there. He's experiencing the torture that Molly's actually going through, or the problems from that. Is that something which, again, works, or would you have liked to have seen a more clearly defined and villain for the hero to work through? Or is it just, again, the case of the nebulous nature of the corporation?
I think that nebulous sense that the menace is out there, it's around us all the time, and it's very hard to actually put your finger on who's doing what, because nobody seems to know, and privacy more than anything else in Gibson's world and in ours becomes so highly prized.
Face recognition software, we hear this week, is actually being applied
absolutely.
To maybe do away with all passports. You just actually have so many computer recognition systems around that we are identified by our face, which I suppose leads to options.
Everyone knows where we are all
on.
The time. Yeah. And of course, if we're not doing anything wrong, we have nothing to fear. Yep.
It's almost a follow-through to 1984, but that's another sort of line that works through that.
But with better technology.
Well, precisely. So, Rob, in terms of the overall sequence from that, cyberspace, virtual reality, and so on, I mean, talk about 1984, Brave New World also put up from that. The title itself, New Romancer, plays around with inner neurons, etc. Is it something which you say, yeah, I'm going to give it another shot? I'm going to actually sort of battle through this and see where it goes, where it takes me? Or would you say, no, I'll give it 30 years?
I wonder what it'd be like in 30 years, hence, because you've quoted a few books there, 1984, which is what written in the late 40s, wasn't it?
1948?
Yeah, 1948, and thought up probably in Stockton, where, you know. So.
Well,
it'll be interesting to see if
that's George Orwell, Eric Blair. It's what he's going to do. We've got a George Orwell symposium coming up, actually, in June.
Right.
Richard Keeble is actually coordinating. But yes, so again, would you sort of say, it needs another appraisal?
Yeah, I think it's true. We're looking back at a book that's written in the 80s, and I'm seeing it in a totally different way. That I don't think I would have been able to read it in the 80s. I wouldn't have understood it at all.
I find it very difficult, actually, like Jenny. I mean, it was one of those things which one felt, because one had one was an aficionado for science fiction and so on, that you effectively, or an affiliation for these things, that you would actually sort of, one was duty-bound to get hold of a copy. But it's a bit like The Brief History of Time. In another sort of sense, where you sort of think, oh, must get a hold of a copy of that, and you sort of give out, which is obviously a factual side of things. We're not saying Stephen Hawking writes fiction. I'm sure he does. He's appeared in Star Trek The Next Generation. Time is moving on, and we need the scores on the doors. So, Rob, what would you actually provide William Gibson's New Romancer?
8.
An 8. Jenny?
I think it stood the test of time very well for 30 years, and it's so original even now. I'll give it 8.5.
And I think I'll go for 8.5 as well, actually. I think we'll work through that. And as you rightly said, it has resonated. It was originally suggested to us by John Jarrold, a literary agent, of course, and keen SF soul, who will hopefully be joining us on one of these shows in the very near future. But we've got even more exciting stuff, because once again, we're on location. Well, actually, after a fashion, we'll be going on location, but you'll be able to meet both Rob and Jenny as part of the Lincoln-inspired festival, where our sister station, Siren FM, presents Read All About It at the Bookstop Cafe. That's 3 p.m. on Tuesday the 6th of May. Are you looking forward to it? This is your second visit to Lincoln in a matter of months, Rob. You
know, it is.
The fans are very appreciative of the whole thing. But Rob Nichols is returning. We'll be with author Catherine Feeney, and of course Jenny, you'll be there as well.
I will indeed.
Excellent. Excerpts from that. And I do believe we'll also be joined by Michael Blackburn, so a chance to actually touch base in the Bookstop Cafe on Tuesday the 6th of May. But even more wonderful stuff is the next book that we're going to be focusing on in May, as far as this show is concerned. Jenny, it is?
Right, next month's book is Mr. Two Bombs by William Coles.
I think it's just Mr. Two Bomb, actually.
Mr.
Two Bomb. Ooh. Exactly. So it's just one man, two atomic bombs, and an epic story of love, loss, and redemption. By William Coles, on the Book of the Month for Southside Broadcasting.
Jenny Finch, author, creator of The Drowners and Death of the Elver Man, and general Renaissance woman, your host for the Book of the Month.